Okay, the work session is in order. So we'll do a quick roll call here. Commissioner Hanselman?
I am here.
Vice Chairman and Commissioner Berman?
I'm also here.
And the Commissioner from California?
Wait a minute, Hawaii. That looks like Hawaii from Hawaii, yeah.
Been hanging out with Capri.
Oh, God, that's it.
Mr. Updike is here.
Going over to the light side.
And of course, Mr. Escobar, he's there.
Good evening, folks.
Good evening.
And it looks like we may have Commissioner Blum on the phone. Okay. I just see a phone number. Is that you, Marjorie?
Yes, that's me.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
That's me. Do I unmute myself?
I hope you're doing okay.
Yeah, I'm okay. Thank you.
Okay, which point in time? Had the call to order in unfinished business. Apparently not.
Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do this.
Unfinished business?
Yeah, and let's start with the City Center Revitalization Project. Okay. You have a copy of the most current draft, and it's still draft, but almost final draft of the scope of work for the project, along with a schedule that's been rebuilt. As many of you know, this is a project that is a high priority to the councils and the commissions. It builds on the transportation system plan that we recently completed. The transportation system plan covered hundreds of projects citywide. This one's really drilling down on the handful of projects in the city center core area along 101 and 20, with particular emphasis on sorting out whether or not we go with a couplet or not on 101. And it was the short couplet option. The long couplet got eliminated as part of the TSP work. So we were able to secure some funds from the state through the Transportation Growth Management Program, which is a joint collaboration between the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. TGM grants, one of the tricks with these is they have to be administered by the state, which in this case has slowed the process down. We do have, you know, a consulting team that was selected through what they call a mini RFP process, which means that it was put out to those firms that are pre-qualified to do this type of work through the TGM program. And we have been, the initial scope of work, their proposal on costs was way high. And so it's been the back and forth about getting a scope of work together that works with the project budget. City is bringing to the table $150,000in urban renewal funds. TGM is bringing $180,000 to the table, so $330,000 project. And the scope of work has been kind of reconstituted. The big push point, and it always seems to be the big push point, is outreach. And the cost of outreach and cost of consultant time to assist with outreach. And every time we do a round of outreach, that's a substantial amount of consulting time to engage in whatever the activity is, you know, either in person or online, and then tabulating results and revising reports and so on and so forth. So what we did here was, and this is really kind of where I was hoping we'd go day one, but now they're convinced it's the right way, is to do a charrette style for your principal outreach. I'll kind of walk through it. So first up, you have some stakeholder engagement. This is really to give the consultants a sense of what the issues are, so they can begin to frame the future work. That would be informed by 10 stakeholder interviews and then a 3-hour workshop with a Spanish language breakout. So we either do the Spanish language subgroup at the same time or at some other time, but the same day that the consultants are out here to save on travel. So that would be in person. And from that, they would then put together the information they need for the charrette, which would be event one. And then that would be followed up with an online survey or open house, so as to give people who cannot participate in person the opportunity to provide feedback over 2 to 3 weeks. That timing's flexible. One of the tug of wars you have with them is how, you know, they want to really ratchet down how big an online survey can be. I think it's fair to limit the number of questions. I really don't want to limit the number of slides. Graphics can eat up a lot of a slide. Graphics are needed to convey issues, and they're not hard to embed in a web page. And then the second public event would be an open house. This is not intended to be like the TSP, a long process with to cover all of the different aspects in the TSP of all those different projects. This is a little bit more strategic, and we'd like to structure this so that we can be more focused. And so I do appreciate this current format in that regard. The product, because this again is ODOT, we deal with tech memos, and so there are 9 of them. Beginning at the beginning, you're talking about goals and objectives, then moving in, the second one is existing conditions, the third is a market analysis, the fourth I think will be really interesting. Eco Northwest is going to be leading that one's the gap analysis, so taking a look at, you know, here's where we want to go, here what the existing conditions are, and starting to weave some of that together. And then what you would have is on 5 is a set of planning, comp plan and code concepts. So this isn't your amendments. This is a, here's where we can go with this to help achieve desired objectives, pros, cons. Some of those will get kicked out through the process before you do a deep dive in preparing the actual text language. So that's the concept with it. 6 would be public investments needed to achieve objectives. 7 has to do with the incentives, public-private partnerships needed to achieve objectives. 8 is multimodal mobility impact assessment. This one's going to be required considering the source of funds. And I think it's useful to I mean, we want to create a conditions in the city center and in the US 20, these commercial core areas, where people can walk to work, to get their, you know, to restaurants and other services and or ride bikes. You know, is this going to start to help us get away from a vehicle oriented, you know, transportation pattern, which is what we have right now. And then the last one is the actual plan and code amendments. So from code concepts, which was Memo 5, Memo 9 is going to have the real deal, the final kind of stuff. And so each of those will go through rounds of amendments. This does have a citizen advisory committee that the council will need to impanel. They would be meeting 6 times, as they've outlined here. As outlined right now, looks like we'll be starting around September, and it's going to run through basically 2024. We'll need to kind of wrap things up about then. That's when the TGM grant needs to be fully utilized. And that seems to be a reasonable schedule. I included in your packet kind of the schedule that they built out for each of these items. I guess what I'm looking for you is, one, if you have any comments on the scope, if the schedule seems reasonable, if there are any further adjustments that could be made to improve the process before we finalize this, and they go under contract, and we have a formal grant agreement that goes to council. Yeah, Bob?
Well, it struck me, I mean, one of the very first things is some initial meeting that they say it was going to be virtual, then later they say, well, two consultant staff will be here, the rest will be, I don't know how you do a site visit virtually. Does somebody carry around an iPhone and point at things as you're talking about them? Have you ever had any experience with that? Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And 2 hours doesn't seem to make enough sense to cover the target, not just the focus areas, but the entire physical scope of the project area.
Okay.
And then on the advisory committee, well, first of all, is it appropriate at this point to say I would be interested in doing that? If it's something that gets deferred till later, that's fine too, but put me down as a volunteer for that. And
you guys will make a formal appointment on the, yeah, I think you actually had made a recommendation previously. It was going to be Jim Patrick, and now he's no longer here. So, but Jim may end up applying to serve in a citizen capacity, for all I know.
Okay, but this, it does have council and planning commission liaison.
Absolutely.
So,
I mean, if you guys want to, at your regular session, make a recommendation on who serves in that capacity.
Well, maybe fine. We ought to wait till we're all back together.
You have time for that. That's probably the wise move. Then that way everybody has a chance to
everybody
chime in.
Yeah. And the, I don't know what the permanent member, they say the community advisory committee can reach out to other people. But one of the really big things that's been guaranteed is some kind of space for the farmers market has to come out of this. So some kind of representative from that community, whether it be the person that runs it, and I don't know who that is, or, you know, somebody. Anyway, farmers market has to be rolled into here. And it does say Lincoln County, but I'd like to see it more specific as the Planning Commission and the Housing Authority.
Commissioner Blum has her hand up. Commissioner
Blum
has her hand up to speak.
There's a hand.
Oh, yeah. Hurry, hold on her.
Go ahead, Margie.
Unmute you. She's on mute, though.
You there, Margie?
Well, her hand is there.
Now she's off mute.
I meant to try to mute myself, so I did *9. So I didn't have a question. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Other thoughts?
A question about from a geography standpoint, mm-hmm. You have the two focus areas. Do you see, I mean, there's issues that are common to both, but there's also issues that are very particular mm-hmm. to one versus the other. So is that sort of running in a simultaneous fashion in terms of how these open houses and community input would be sought? Is this like a tabling thing and you might...
Yep.
I'm interested in this section, not that.
Yep.
How do you see that coming together?
Yeah, they'll have to, on the in-persons probably, at least have a little bit of a breakout for those that say are more US 20 oriented questions. It's a little bit different than the US 101. This project stands a chance of getting, almost entirely absorbed by the couplet or no couplet conversation. So they're going to need to be sensitive to making sure that that isn't, you know, 95% of the discussion. And,
right.
Lose all the other pieces that we want to talk about.
Oh, that reminds me, Derek. When we were doing testimony on TSB, I believe it was Barbara Boxer gave a really passionate testimony about why we shouldn't have the couplet. And she was eloquent, to the point, And if it wasn't Barbara Box, it was somebody else.
Charlotte? I don't know, Barbara Boxer, she represented the Senate in California for a long time.
I know a Barbara Boxer.
I know a Charlotte Boxer.
Charlotte Boxer. Yes. I think that's who it was. Yes. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
She would be a good one to at least be involved. I don't know whether you're going to take the TSP list and just roll it forward for the first mailing or contact?
Yeah, the council's going to need to put together the advisory committee, so they're going to need to do those appointments. So we'll do a recruitment on that. We have time, and so we'll reach out and give people an opportunity to apply. Where people were at the TSP in terms of their personal time and ability to commit to a project like this may not be where they are now. So,
I was thinking in terms of the list that got developed.
We'll certainly be utilizing that list to reach out to folks and building on it. But who chooses to apply to try to serve on the advisory committee, we'll see how that plays out.
Well, again, all I was thinking was like for the mailings and the email blasts,
yep.
We already have a big chunk of names and addresses.
Yes, we do, and we'll be using that.
That one group had like 10 or 15 signatures.
Okay, Braulio?
Well, you know, I concur with Derek in saying that the couplet concept is probably going to be the lightning rod, which will generate the most community involvement. If I recall, not only did Ms. Boxer express opposition, but also the former city councilor, Mr. Bertolite, he was also eloquent and also put a lot of letters to the editors out there. So ultimately, Derek, my question is will the idea of the concept be either approved or denied by the city council, number one? And number two, it seems historically when an idea of a couplet is proposed, there's initial community opposition, but then after it's done, people kind of accept it and move on with their life. And I point to the couplet in Philomath. And it wasn't that long ago when there was an outrage there in Benton County. But now that the couplet's employed, it's certainly easier for us to drive into and through Philomath. So I just would toss that out there for in terms of the citizen involvement. That's probably going to be the one item that draws the most attention.
Yeah, this process is intended to delve into this to a level of detail that it's going to answer unanswered questions at this point in time, and it will give people an opportunity to more fully engage on the issue. There certainly was support and opposition to a couplet. There was a lot of misinformation with respect to what these transportation solutions bring to the table, either the no couplet with enhanced bike ped on 9th or the couplet. This is going to get this mapped out in enough detail that we should be able to break through, and folks will have a better understanding of what the two options will do and make a more informed choice of their own in terms of, you know, which ones they think are better for the community or not.
Well, but Braulio brings up a good point. This is a year and a half process.
Right.
And a lot of the final document, like alternatives and, well, not alternatives, but financial incentives, mm-hmm. Are going to be, have to be tailored depending on whether or not there is a couple. And so at what point in this whole process is that decision made and by whom?
Well, at the end of the day, it's to be made by the council. I mean, that's the transportation solutions in the TSP. And it also has to be an option that's supported by the state. We're not dealing with a city facility, we're dealing with a state facility. So those are the two keys there. It's, you know, it has to be supported by the state and ultimately adopted by the council. I'll talk more with the team about timing on that. I take your point, Bob. It doesn't necessarily have to have a formal decision on that in advance of these other pieces. And you know, there's, and to do that presents its own challenges because it could just totally eat up the entire room. All the oxygen gets sucked into that discussion point.
Yeah,
and I don't know that all of the code concepts necessarily. I don't. well, dramatic. I don't know that the code concepts necessarily are going to be dramatically different between a couplet or a non-couplet.
Not the coding, code concepts, but some of the financial incentives for, you know, storefront grants, for example. Are they going to be, they're going to be available in a specific geographical area. That area will be different depending on whether there's a couplet or not.
But the nature of the grant may not be.
Right. Well, probably wouldn't be.
So yeah. So some of that stuff could be left till, you know, which towards the end of the process for ultimate adoption. But I'll talk to them more about it. And they know it's probably the most sensitive issue through the whole process and how that gets addressed. But I think one key we want to make sure is we don't want that to overwhelm some of the other pieces. Mm-hmm.
We were talking about tearing down one of the storefronts in the Deco district there because it had been vacant a long time, was structurally unsound.
Yeah, the Urban Renewal Agency is moving forward with acquiring properties in these target areas because it's appropriate to do so, irrespective of which, you know, option is ultimately for 101 is selected. So yeah, the agency acquired the property next to the kite shop, and that building will be torn down. The agency acquired is about to close. We're in a purchase agreement, so it's all public. It's just a matter of timing for closing. The old gas station right north of City Hall, which is relevant to this process because if you were to do a couplet, well, one, that's valuable for overall campus kind of reconfiguring anyway. But if you were to do a couplet, that also plays into what the look and feel of it is as that comes back in to a conventional two-way alignment. If we're losing parking on the south side of City Hall, that creates an area where parking could be added. You know, there's some things like that that can play with that. And we're also in the process of closing, actually this week, on the Salvation Army property down at the other end of the city center area, down by the hospital. The vacant, four vacant lots there, kind of sandwiched in between the adult bookstore and the
Hot Trot.
Yeah.
The dental office.
Is there?
Down in that area.
Braulio, I think, wanted to say something. He's been.
I guess another question is there a sense that the folks who operate the farmers market, are they pretty dedicated to that location, or do you think they'd be amenable to relocation? And if they're going to be relocated, then the question becomes, where would they be relocated to?
Well, I think we've had council members that's a key piece. The farmers market needs to be whole through this process. That's a commitment the council's made. There have been comments from some council members also pointing out that, hey, look, you know, through this process, the farmers market may get a better venue than it has now. And we have to keep in mind that parking lot there is interim use. That is not a long-term use of that property. That property was purchased for future campus expansion. That's why the council bought it at the time. It made sense for it to be a parking lot in the interim because it's a lower cost investment and it has benefits and it's worked well for the farmers market and various other events the city has in the rec center and the aquatic facility. But that shouldn't be viewed as a permanent fixture. It's going to get redeveloped. If we didn't do the couplet, it still would be a target for redevelopment. This process, at some point, I can't say when that redevelopment would occur, but I mean, logically, you can think at some point there would be a general obligation bond proposal for a new police, maybe a new joint police fire facility or something like that. You know, it's that kind of stuff comes up from time to time, and it's important that you strategically have some property that can be utilized for that purpose. But yeah, whatever comes of this, farmers market, you know, they need to be engaged in part of the process and that they'd be looking, or council certainly is clear that they want to see a permanent venue that works well for them.
Well, they've been here a number of times speaking with us, the leadership of the farmers market. And whenever I talk to them, the number one priority that seems to come through is visibility. they want visibility. And 101 has offered that. And I always get a little worried when other people say, well, we'll find a spot for them. Without any discussion beyond that, we'll find a spot for them. But farmers markets really do well when they're visible. That's what brings people. So I hope if the county is gonna get involved in this and helping to find a place for the farmers market, I hope visibility is as high a priority to them as it is to the farmers market folks.
I think, you know, the expectation is that it would be along a 101 alignment. So, you know, whether or not that 101's coupled it or not, I mean, you're still dealing with 101 visibility and a substantial amount of vehicle traffic.
I have a question. It's off subject matter a little bit, but we're seeing this happen nationwide after the professor wrote his book about excessive parking lots in the nation. And now many states are jumping on the concept that we don't need all this parking. And it's gone down to the state level where people are now suggesting there will be no off-street parking required for residential properties and so on and so forth. And this is all dandy. That's what they want to do. But there seems to be a fair amount of commercial property and parking lots that could serve as residential areas if we didn't have this restriction on ground floor in commercial areas. Is there anybody at the DLCD or state that thinks that maybe using some of this commercial property that's available?
Oh, sure. That was on the list of there was one vote, as you know, for 3414. It was in the paper. One vote in the Senate went the other way, and that would have been adopted as law, and that included allowing residential and street grade and commercial areas, except they tried to frame out those that are more tourist-oriented. I mean, as you might imagine, if your economy relies upon tourist-oriented kind of commercial areas, and you allow those to get co-opted for residential, you're going to have a pretty big economic hit. So we're trying to... And they also don't want to create they like the live work, and so if you have a good, healthy, vibrant live work area, they don't want that just turned into live with work somewhere else, and now you're back into the car. I mean, so that was the balancing act that they had with that, but there certainly was relief in that package to local government requirements that prohibit residential at street grade. And by the way, we already, as you guys know, have made that more lenient because of changes in state law as it relates to affordable housing projects. We were required to, and we built that into our code. You know, and parking, yeah. I mean, you know, the league spent a lot of time trying to convince the governor's office that don't treat rural areas exactly like you treat metro areas. We don't have the robust transit and cycling options that they do. We're further away from a lot of the necessary services that people need. Our street networks, sidewalk systems are not as, you know, connected, you know, and so, but they didn't bite. And I do expect, you know, the league's saying 3414 in some form is probably going to come up in the short session. What it looks like is probably going to be a little bit different than what it looked like this time. The whole reason that went down was not what we're talking about, but was because the property rights advocates got a language in there that would have allowed a loosening up of urban growth boundaries, and that got Thousand Friends flipped to the POS. And once you got Thousand Friends and some of their aligned groups opposed, they were able to pull enough senators such that didn't get through. And that was a late add. I mean, that was like the last amendment right before they were voting on the stuff.
Yeah.
And everything was moving real fast at that point.
Well, it had to.
Yeah.
At that particular point.
I think, you know, if we're faced with that, one thing I think we could do is we could lift the we could start saying, hey, look, you're not going to get to do a shared street option if you're trying to do some infill development, if you want to get a waiver from off-street parking. The parking's got to go somewhere. If we don't have the stalls in this, you know, in the public right of way, they got to happen on the private property. We're not in a position to have no parking at all in either arena, you know. And so, I mean, we're dealing with some of these tough infill areas where you've got very narrow rights of way. So it's not really an option to just say, hey, let's not worry about off-street, and somehow they're going to get accommodated in those narrow rights of way, because they won't. And it'll create enforcement problems for the city and issues for emergency responders trying to get to fires when their equipment can't navigate around parked vehicles that are slopping over well within the travel lane. A little bit off topic, though, you're right.
Well, it is. It's just, you know, the one thing that comes up in the city is the lack of housing. We have work for people, but we have no housing for them. Beyond affordable, even. I mean, most of what's being built now is market rate. And that seems to be, people can afford to do that. But we know that there are probably hundreds of people that can't afford market rate. And the CET program is what we were trying to do to get a little incentive for people to build. But you also need the land to build on, and that's why I was pushing the commercial thing.
I think with respect to this project, though, there almost inevitably will be an emphasis on residential above commercial in the city center,
and
which is a perfectly sensible solution if it's done right.
And to Bob's point there, we've had conversations with affordable housing providers. They like a model where you could get three floors of housing above ground floor, where you could have childcare and, you know, related types of services.
That housing projects could benefit from. Sure, that makes sense. So, but I mean, when you've got fish processing plants basically renting out a whole motel for housing for their workers, we cannot assume that there's enough housing in this market here.
Nope.
So, you know, I'm willing to let it go into commercial areas.
Brilliant.
Mr. Braulio.
My other thought is, you know, circling back to your comment about market rate housing, is sometimes that market rate housing isn't affordable for those first working, you know, in entry-level positions or at the fish plant, and then that causes them to seek housing further away from their job site, which then requires more transportation, more parking, and so it's kind of a very complex issue with how do we encourage housing where people are living and working. I mean, look what happens in Yahats. Very few of the folks who are working in the hotels or the restaurants can afford to live in the Yahats unless the employer is providing the housing. And so I think that's the concept that we should be alert to in our community.
Okay, moving on.
Next item. Does Marjorie have her hand up, or is that? It's been
it
up. Just left it up? Okay.
Yeah.
Better take it down, but I got to figure that out.
No worries. Okay, next item we have is a grant application we're going to be submitting. DLCD, Department of Land Conservation Development, received a fair amount of funds this biennium. It's coming out of this last legislative session. For planning assistance that's housing related, and there were a few different pots. This one's going to be would fall in a pot where they have $2.5 million to distribute statewide. And so this application, and the council's already done their resolution. I think I included it in your packet here in terms, because we need to get a resolution done before we submit. Although I found out today enough cities from the state that enough cities complain that they'll allow them to now follow up with their resolutions after the deadline. But we're good at this point. This researching the feasibility of a rental housing maintenance code was actually one of the priority items for implementation in the housing production strategy. It was one of those that was actually bumped up to earlier work because of feedback we had from the public on that. And so I have to get that grant application put together and submitted by the end of the month, which is coming up rapidly. And, was looking for your feedback on this. You know, a couple of thoughts I have, what we're looking at it, we're hoping to do here would be to look at different models for how this is done, something that's scalable for a community of our size. We can't necessarily do the Eugene approach or a Portland approach or some approach where it's a larger jurisdiction with large staff who can do that. Some of these different models might be, more narrowly tailoring what we're trying to go after in terms of, making sure that, electrical systems are operation, plumbing, keep it fairly narrowly tailored, and not get into some of the cosmetic stuff that, you could with this type of program. You could set up a model where, you contract the service and you have it done, have the inspections done annually, where you try to keep it a little bit more targeted, in a manner that you can address, because when you do these inspections, you identify issues and you're going to be generating work, which is good. I mean, because you want them to improve those units, but that's going to mean permits and inspections, and we need to be prepared to support that. Part of this was trying to figure out what type of consultant would be good at this. This is, our building official, Joseph, built one of these for San Luis Obispo before he came up here, but I can't ask Joseph to spend a considerable amount of time on this project because his time's committed already to plan reviews and inspections. He can provide strategic input, and I think he's happy to do that, but he's not prepared to carve out a huge amount of time to work on this.
Has he announced retirement date?
Nope. The, it has to be fee supported. We have to think about a fee support structure on this. Engagement and how do we want to do engagement? It strikes me, you've got a couple of different, you've got engaging the rental owners, which are likely may not be all that receptive to this initially. So that's going to take a little bit of work.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure of that.
By the way, are STRs included?
Short-term rentals?
Yeah.
On a rental housing maintenance?
Yeah.
Hadn't thought to include them.
Yeah, I mean, they have their own separate inspection measurement.
Right.
That's probably tougher than anything we're going to come up with.
But I would think if there's talk about a fee schedule, those ought to be included. There's fiscal capacity there for
their fees supporting their own.
Granted, it's a whole other set of folks marching on City Hall, but fair is fair. It's rental.
Oh no, but fair is fair is there are, just so you know, they are already paying a surcharge for the vacation rental inspection and recertification program. So it's almost like, so they've got theirs already. We don't have something that's corresponding for habitability, which is what this is really getting at, that people have a right to be able to live in a habitable unit.
Do we have counts on just how many non-short-term rental, non-affordable housing, I'm looking at all those exemptions from Eugene, how many are left that could actually be the potential funding source for this? Or does that have to be part of the study?
That's going to have to be part of the study.
Okay.
Because it's a feasibility study.
Okay.
One of those may, and the inventory's got to be part of it. Inventory of units, general condition. I don't know that we're going to be able to break it down to.
So we didn't get that out of the housing
study that was done that didn't get that kind of data.
No, I think it's even higher. I mean, we have number of multifamily units, but we're going to need to break this down to specific complexes, age of the complexes, and we don't have that level of detail.
And our
chime in. Yeah, I want to take a mild exception to Derek's memorandum. I was on the housing committee, and the comments about the rental housing code was inserted by the consultant, and at that time I raised the concern that there already was state statutes which mandated the habitability issues, you know, the electricity, the water, the sewage, the roofing, and all of those types of things. There was then a comment by Pastor Judith from the Episcopal Church saying that some of her congregants or her people who follow her were concerned about mold. And I then responded that, you know, there's a mechanism for renters to address this with the landlord. They have they can have a rent strike or things like that. One thing, when we start talking about fees, those fees are going to be passed on to the renter. The landlord's not going to absorb them. So I would hope that we would move fairly cautiously on this. I don't really see, in opposition to what Derek might be suggesting, a groundswell from the population that this is something that we need to move on with dispatch. But those are just my comments on this, that you're going to create more work for the staff. There's going to be a fee structure which is going to be passed on to the tenant. And are we looking for a cure for a problem that may not exist? That's just a thought.
Well, you know, again, the commitment's to do a feasibility study. The commitment is not to implement a program. And I think those are two very different things. And the feasibility study is going to delve into these issues in greater detail. Council certainly supported the moving forward. That's why they backed a resolution on this. And we did get feedback through the housing production strategy that you know, a rental maintenance was something that a number of the respondents cared about. Now, whether or not at the end of the day it's something that's supportable, I mean, that's what a feasibility analysis is about, whether or not we have enough units that are potential issues, whether or not we could cost effectively, you know, lift up a program. I mean, that's all part of what this is. So this is not a commitment, I want to be clear, to do the program. It's a commitment to do the feasibility study.
Again, in terms, it's pretty important to define scope of rental right. properties. So you got STRs, you've got second homes that are rented on a month-to-month basis, and I don't know how you ever find those. They could be anywhere at any time and come and go regularly. So that's something that needs to be addressed in terms of the scope of the project. And, you know, to reiterate what Braulio said, the last thing we want to do is reduce housing by imposing some onerous restrictions to the point where slumlords will just say, screw it, I'll tear the building down and sell the lot. And we lose units. And there is some really bad units in this town. I can tell you, Braulio, and I go on my Meals on Wheels route, there's places that I don't even want to go into, much less live in.
Bob?
Some really bad housing.
I represent a landlord in Toledo, and I can share with you experiences of housing that may not meet the habitability standard. So I agree with you on that issue.
So some nice middle ground, you know, where you don't put an undue burden on the landlord, but you make livability mandated by the city.
Well, there's probably a chance that some rental units will have to be taken off the market if there is a maintenance code.
Well, that's what I'm afraid of.
You know, just because they're not livable, and the amount of money to make them livable is beyond the landlord's interest.
There's some single wide parts that are just, wow.
I mean, Anybody who went to college and rented off-campus housing has probably lived in some of these.
I was in one called Nanook Niches one time. The mold was working its way up the walls.
Oh, yeah, mushrooms in the bathroom. You know, come on.
All right, I think it's a good idea to do the study, but I hope it's not a foregone conclusion that there will be a COVID.
I would share that in San Francisco, toughening up the maintenance standards and adding in, I think I talked about this before, a provision to allow representation of those, because often it's that a tenant doesn't understand what their rights are and needs advocacy. But with all of that, I mean, I've been through the SROs in Chinatown, and it didn't result in loss of units. It resulted in better units, by and large.
Did it change the rent?
It does work. Does it change your rent? Well, if there's so many dynamics, is it the market that changed the rent? Was it a policy that changed the rent? That's a tough one to answer.
Did the rent change?
The rent certainly has changed.
Yeah.
But they always do. I mean, that's always going to happen. I think one of the tricks here too is engagement. I mean, engaging the owners, you know, just like we're almost going to need to do two separate engagements: one with the owners and those, and then one with the tenants. Because I doubt it would be terribly productive to try to do that together. And so, you know, people aren't going to be willing to share, even if you could get them at the same table necessarily. So that's another piece that I was thinking I'm going to need to be kind of artful with in terms of how do we craft the engagement piece to better understand the core issues, both from the landlord's perspective and the tenant's perspective, to help inform the process.
It's tough.
Yeah.
I assume mobile home parks or, you know, places like across from Embarcadero, that would have to be included. Although probably half the people there are owners.
Well, it's an interesting thing you bring that one up, because yeah, that's Harbor Village. They just bought their park. But so they're. I mean, yeah, they absolutely need to be engaged. And I think part of that too for them is they'll have an interesting perspective to share now that they are park owners. You know, and some of the challenges they're struggling through modernizing their infrastructure in their park. I'm sure they have, you know, a number of things they'd like to share. Okay. Anything else on this one? Yeah, I got some fun writing to do. It's probably going to be, I've reached out. Madras is, you know, I'm trying to find other smaller communities that are actually looking at this issue. So Madras is starting to tackle it. I'll be talking to their community development director here shortly, there are a couple of different consultants I'll be bouncing this off of, because I think you're going to have different, and then a Fair Housing Council, I'll be reaching out to them as well, just you know, for their perspective on this particular topic. My suspicion is it's going to be a small team of consultants, because you know, you're going to have one group, maybe like an FCS group, that's good at how do you pay for it and doing that kind of analysis, and you're going to have somebody else entirely who's looking at fair housing or the base, you know, habitability issues. I'm doubt when we're going to find somebody who does all of that. See?
This is a time when we really miss the input of Lee Hardy.
Yeah. I think her business is closed, I believe.
Yeah, I think after she passed, her estate was no longer interested in running the business. The employees were laid off, and I think a lot of her her clients were scrambling to find new management.
As one of her clients, I can confirm that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. CET funds.
Derek, one quick question. Sorry. Do you expect this to be similar to the downtown study area grant, or and it's a state grant, so the state?
No, this one's different.
The locality gets to have a little more control.
We get more control on this, and we just deal with it on a reimbursement basis, either
great,
Like the housing one, that was the same as this one. Housing, we just reimbursed at the end of the process. It's easier that way. I mean, I have to do a whole lot of administrative stuff on the reimbursements. So the fewer of those through the process, the better. Otherwise, it just sucks up our time. So, but we get more flexibility with that, you know, because we control kind of the scope of work. We're the ones directly engaged with consultants. They're more responsive to us. The challenge sometimes with the TGMs, the City Center Revitalization, similar with the TSP project, because there was ODOT doesn't do it that way. You know, they won't do that. If they have money on the that's part of a planning process, they're going to control the planning process in terms of the administrative side of it, which then means the consultants are a little bit more responsive to them. But I'm not saying that they're not responsive to us. It's just it's a little bit different. They're just a little bit more engaged on the state side because the state's the one who's signing the checks.
Yeah. Okay. Do we get a lot of citizen complaints over abnormally high rent increases that the landlords do?
I wouldn't say no, because we're not the venue where they would raise those issues, typically. I think they would raise those with the state agency, given some of the state laws. They're not going to raise it with the city so much.
There was a state statute which capped the amount of rental increases that a landlord could impose, and that increase was actually tied to inflation as a result of the high inflation in 2022, the amount of increased rent that a landlord could impose was practically 14%. I don't think many landlords elevated their rent 14%, but there was some increase. The legislature then in 2023, I think they've capped it at, I think it's 10% at this point.
10%, okay. Yeah, I'm just recalling off the top of my head, and Brawley, you may know this, who is charged with providing oversight on that at the state level? Is it Oregon Housing Community Services?
I just don't know who imposes it. You know, I'd have to check that out, Derek.
Okay. Well, those are things that can be discovered through the process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, ready?
Okay, CET funds.
Right. Well, this will only take about 7 minutes because it's actually a little bit more targeted anyway. One of the commitments we made also with the housing production strategy is to do a couple things with the CET collections. One is make it as flexible as possible. So divert as much of what we're collecting to the flex fund as we're legally permitted to do. And that means the commercial and commercial industrial side collections can be diverted to the flex fund, not apportioned like the residential have to be apportioned by statute, which is the 15-35-50. Important to keep in mind, multifamily projects, while commercial under a building code, would be viewed as residential under this one. And they've paid quite a bit, as you probably noticed from the chart I attached. But that would be considered a residential collection, even though it's a commercial project from a code perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do we have any projects upcoming or ongoing that are commercial?
Well, we always have a number of commercial projects moving through the pipeline. They, you know, most of them tend to be smaller, but we have a couple big ones. I mean, Toyota Newport's about to break ground on 26,000 square foot new dealership. That would be a very clear example of a commercial project that's about to kick off. The hotel that just paid their stuff, the Whaler, that's commercial.
I mean,
so we do have them, and we also, though, you know, we've got a few multifamily in the pipeline. So we've got the final phase of Whaler, which is going to probably come in for permitting so they can break ground in 24. So they're not far from submitting applications to us. That's another 90 units. They're doing their site prep right now up there at Harney and 36th. We've got another development, 60 to 75 units, market rate, that's going to come in on South Beach. Down by across from the townhouses as you head out to Idaho Point, there's some property back off 35th, back behind the Bartow family property.
In the floodplain?
No, there's enough of it. There's floodplain back there, Bob. Plenty of floodplain, wetlands back there. But there's a big chunk that's elevated back there that had the farmhouse and a number of outbuildings.
Oh, that was the artist. What was
Bartow.
Yeah. All right.
That was it. That's where. And so that one, another market rate, either 60 or 75 units, depending on, they had one additional parcel they had an option on bringing into that. So, you know, so one of the things we need to look at, this, the development incentives piece, which is the 50% of the residential collections, has to be doled out really for multifamily and large multifamily, so projects of 20 plus units. So I showed you the three that we've had. We had the one up Oxenhole did 28 units up in Wilder. They paid theirs. And then Windhaven's two phases, 60 and 78, I believe, or something like that. You know, I've talked to Todd Woodley with Windhaven. He understands why they have to pay it. They don't like paying it because they feel like, hey, at least we're bringing units on the market. And doors. We're getting tagged.
We're bringing you doors.
Yeah, we're bringing in units, albeit at market rate, you know, and why are we having to, you know, pay this stiff, in their mind, you know, affordable housing, CET, and it's not cheap. It's 1% of market value, so it hits them. You know, one approach, and I think really the only viable one I can think in my mind here is we can use a portion of what we collect. Well, we can use our collections to offset a portion of their other expenses. Building permit fees, SDCs. It's not going to fully offset what we collect from them. We don't have enough to really do that. But it's kind of like kind of trying to dial it in. Is that a, you know, 40%? I'd like to probably do a percentage one. It says, look, if you're coming in over 20 units of market rate, we're going to use some of the affordable housing development incentive money we have to give you a X percent rebate on your SDCs and building fees. Keep it simple like that.
For market rate?
Right.
Project?
And in doing that, they have to then reserve a few of their units as affordable. I forgot to mention that. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, better be a hook.
No, and that's the thing. I got to talk to them a little bit about that. You know, how many units to get how much. Maybe it's a scaled thing. You get, you know, if you reserve X number of units, you get 10%. You know, Y number of units, you get 20%.
Yeah.
How do you administratively track that? And, you know, do you go over there and say, okay, show me the units, and then ask the tenants how much they're paying? Or, I mean, you know, it could be a real time sink to administer it if you don't just trust the
owner. Yeah, there'll be a tracking piece, and I've got to put some thought to that. But yeah, there will be a tracking piece. And it may not be in perpetuity either, you know. So we're not talking about necessarily affordable for forever. Maybe it's affordable for some period of time.
What did we do at Surfview? It was 10 years?
Surfview is a long time because that's 85% public funding between the federal low-income housing tax credits and the state's funds on that. And I want to say that's more like a 50 years or more, maybe. Huh. It's a long, long term.
There was something I thought that was 10 years, one of the pieces, but.
Oh, 10 years is us. That was our property tax
exemption
on that. That maxes at 10 years, and they got the $1.6 million in the property tax exemption, which was the 10-year on structural improvements. That's what you were thinking of.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, they're hooked into the affordability with the state for a much longer period of time. And I don't think, you know, given the amount of money we're talking about here, we're not talking, I think 10 would probably be more reasonable. Not, you know, we're not looking at something too far down, or they're just simply not going to do it. It's just not beneficial to them.
Okay, so you're not proposing any change in the rates or any of the mechanisms, it's just how to use it.
Yeah, we need to do that. And so, I mean, I just want to bounce the concept. I mean, that seems like the one reasonable thing we can do. I can't think of a whole lot of other things that you can do, given how tight the state's ratcheted that development incentive down. It basically says, look, it's got to be for multifamily. They got to be big projects, and it has to, you know, And, you know, buying down SDCs and building permit fees is something you can do. Okay. We can structure that. So, you know. And so what I'd bring back is some more specifics in that. I'll try to correlate that to what some other folks are doing. Come up with a reasonable time frame for how long they have to maintain them as affordable. And we would key the affordability off of the same thing the state uses, so it'd be off the HUD rental charts for, you know, 60 or 80% median area income.
Does the county have any dedicated staff or resources that would do the checking, the auditing of?
Good question.
Or the public housing
authority?
You know,
Karen Rockwell over there with who's the new director at the housing authority has been open to taking on a more expanded role than they have traditionally. I don't know if it's this expansive. Never hurts. You can always ask, you know.
So it seems like we are in favor of seeing a proposal consistent with
this. I didn't hear anybody freak out, yeah. So sounds like.
I'm supportive.
Okay.
Are we using, I noticed in the packet that they were using incomes of 80 to 120% of the mean family income. Are those the percentages that we have used in the past?
Typically for affordability, you're looking at 60 or 80.
Yeah.
You know, you both of them can come into play. I know our property tax exemption, we have 60 and 80, depending on how many units you're reserving. 120 would be, that's more market.
Well, and that's what this is kind of talking about, and I'm just thinking those are people that are making considerably more money than people who would need affordable housing. But again, I don't know how badly I don't know what that turns out to be. What did I read today? 47,000 is the mean family income for Newport, I think I read today in Gomberg's letter to all of his constituents.
I'm surprised at how much higher it was in Lincoln City. That was really shocking. It was like 50%
well,
higher.
What I thought was pretty interesting is that more than one in three residents is older than 65. And those transfer payments that those people bring into the county represent over 27% of the income of this county. Compare that to commercial fishing, which is always pumped as the big one, 4.7% of the county income. So I don't
treat
know
us if, better. Treat us old folks better.
Well, I mean,
what was surprising with the Surfview Village, everybody was talking about how this is going to be great. You know, all this 110 units that could get snapped up by people working in restaurants and doing this other work, you know, a big chunk of those retirees.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it runs the gamut. I mean, while as you said, it's a significant amount of transfer income coming in from retirees who have means.
Yeah.
There are a lot of retirees who don't, and that's, you know, they're looking for that type of housing opportunity, so.
Okay, moving on since it's now after 7.
We're after 7. My golly, how'd we get there?
That's usually not a challenge.
Okay.
So we will close the work group.
You're concerned about the crowd getting restless?
No, I mean,